Now we turn to more recent history to understand the Trump phenomenon with Joe Lowndes, an activist and a professor of political science at the University of Oregon, where he studies right-wing movements, populism, and radical politics. He is the author of From the New Deal to the New Right, Race and the Southern Origins of Modern Conservatism, and is currently writing a book on the right-wing populism in the U.S. Denise Morris recorded Lowndes this past spring at the Portland chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America-sponsored discussion on Trump and the working class. In part one this morning, Joe Lowndes talks about the development of right-wing populism over the last half century and the implications for building broad social movements on the left. Part two will air August 14th and feature journalist and organizer Arun Gupta, who talks about his year of living Trumpishly on the campaign trail and how to make sense of the billionaire Trump's mass appeal. Now here is Joe Lowndes.
Thanks everyone for coming out tonight. I've spent a lot of time in the last year going to Trump events, Trump rallies. I think it's important actually to back up a little bit and try to figure out how we got here. There are a couple of dichotomies I want to talk about, which I think pervade left thinking about Trump and Trumpism. And one, which gets repeated over and over, is the relationship of race and class, or in other words, did Trump support primarily come from people because of racial resentment, xenophobia, etc.? Or was it the result of a sense among white workers of class abandonment, that did decades of deindustrialization, stagnant or declining wages, increasing forms of political powerlessness as a result of this extraordinary gap that what people call the second Gilded Age right now. So what I want to try to show here tonight a little bit is you can't make a clear distinction between race and class in talking about these things, because race, as a Jamaican British theorist Stuart Hall said, race is the mode through which class is lived. And certainly in the case of the United States, class formation and race formation have gone hand in hand. And so there's no way to easily disentangle these things. Even to talk about something we want to call the white working class has already marked it and racialized it in ways that shape the lenses of how we think about these things. The other dichotomy, I think, which happens kind of, I think, is a debate between liberals and the left on how to think about Trumpism. I think after the election, for a lot of liberal pundits, scholars, and other folks, news figures at MSNBC, Trumpism was kind of what social scientists would call, in fancy terminology, an exogenous event, that it came from nowhere, that it was a result of Russian meddling or newly emergent divisions in the Democratic Party or FBI collusion because of Comey, and that as a result we got this entirely unexpected giant angry orange meteor that hit the White House. That's, I think, often the liberal version of what happened and where we are. And there's no way to explain it except for that now we exist under a pall of extraordinary evil, the likes of which we've never seen before, destroying a democracy that seemed to be thriving, doing so well right after November. The other side of the coin here is how many people on the left, I think, talk about Trumpism. And I think a lot of high-profile left thinkers and writers will take this line, particularly people who see Trumpism as merely the latest unfolding of conservatism. But this is just the latest in a long line of conservative Republicans. No more brutal, no more racist, no more misogynist than his predecessors, including Ronald Reagan or Richard Nixon or Barry Goldwater, and that this is just more of the same. And I think that that's also not true. I think that the answer is that we have a little bit of both, that Trumpism is a result of a number of things that have been partly the cost of four decades of neoliberalism and the public world that it has destroyed. It's partly has to do with the expansion of executive power, kind of a Caesarist expansion of executive power, particularly since 9/11, with Bush and then Obama. It's through the kind of the erosion and delegitimation, I think, of Congress and the Supreme Court and other institutions, and also kind of a broadly degraded media environment. So there are these things in place, but also the growing gap between the very rich and everybody else, and Republican ideology has helped us along. Nevertheless, I do think we're in a moment where a certain species of right-wing politics, which is not representative of the Republican Party overall, certainly not representative of George W. Bush's version of the Republican Party, is now in power. And it's the hard populist right version of it. And so I want to talk a little bit about where this comes from and what this animal is. So in some ways, I start with the mid-20s, or really the New Deal era, when there was broadly social democratic imperatives in place that lifted the white working class or organized new immigrants from Eastern and Southern European countries into whiteness, lifted the white working class into a secure and middle class status often through New Deal work programs, New Deal collective bargaining agreements with unions, later through the Federal Housing Authority, through the GI Bill, through a number of other things that we associate with mid-20th century social democracy. The thing about it was that while this lifted up white Americans, it was very difficult to get the New Deal legislation passed, particularly Southern members of Congress, without strong racial exclusions. And so you have in the Agricultural Adjustment Act, in the Social Security Act, in the National Industrial Reorganization Act, specific ways of excluding African Americans, particularly African American workers, and also through myriad dynamics in the unions, in southern states, in other places, there are ways of keeping blacks out of other benefits that would have accrued in the New Deal, leaving blacks more able to avail themselves of relief as opposed to work programs, setting up a long-term association with black dependents and welfare, which we racial images of, we still live with today. But I set that up partly to say that I think partly what happened in the 1960s is, or the 1950s and 60s, the black freedom movement confronting these deep contradictions in the American state allowed the right, which had been kind of in the wilderness since the 1920s, to reassert itself no longer as the party of the rich, but as the party of white people and the party of white workers. First seen in the campaigns of Alabama Governor George Wallace when he ran as a Democrat in 1964, and then as an independent in 1968, and then as a Democrat again in 1972, a language of populism and a bestowing of a certain kind of dignity on white workers, who he described as being beleaguered by liberal elites and bureaucrats and social engineers above, and by black people on welfare who are rioters and disruptors below. And so in the middle you have this kind of white populist middle, which continually has to fight for its own interests. The Republican Party was able to pick up on this and build a new national party out of it with Richard Nixon. Nixon was able to draw together elements of the old white South through the Southern strategy, the new white South of the Sun Belt, and urban industrial workers in the Northeast and the Midwest, and Western populists into a new broad Republican majority that depended on this idea of the defense of white interests, often white working class interests. Nixon was deeply focused on getting union members into the Republican Party, getting people that he called the silent majority, or middle America, or forgotten Americans, to convince them that the Republican Party was no longer the party of the rich, as it had been seen in prior decades, but it was the party of white people broadly, and particularly white middle and working class people. This project, the Silent Majority Project, screeches to a halt with Watergate, but then across the 1970s becomes a kind of a political identity of white Americans, now kind of unmoored from old Democratic Party roots and associations, but unclear where it's going to go. There are elements of right and left-wing politics across the 1970s which draw people in different directions. Conservatives and Republicans themselves were split. People associated with the National Review, like William F. Buckley, were hostile to the populism of the new right. Other people, like Kevin Phillips, who was one of the architects of the silent majority under Nixon, pushed hard for a new right which would incorporate fundamentalists and evangelical Christians, union members, and others. And so this was kind of back and forth across that time. As the 70s wore on, social and political alienation among working and middle-class whites became more pronounced. There's a book, actually, which I think has come back to haunt us now, called The Radical Center, Middle Americans in the Politics of Alienation, written by a guy named Donald Warren. At the time, Warren described middle American radicals, or MARs as he called them, as lower middle class white, often urban ethnic, or white southerners. Mars, Warren argued, had proximate roots in the Wallace campaigns of 68 and 72, but also in the more politically ambiguous trucking strikes of 73 and 74, or the consumer strike against meat prices in the spring of 73. They tended to see both rich and poor as blameworthy for societal ills. As Warren described it, quote, On some issues, Mars are likely to take a liberal stand. On others, a conservative one. For example, Amar expresses a desire for more police power. He feels that granting the police a heavier hand will help them control crime. However, Mars are also adamant about keeping many social reforms, often wrought by the left, such as Medicare, aid to education, and social security. So there's forms of anti-authoritarianism linked with a desire for stronger police power, and a desire to hold on to entitlements like Medicare, but also lurch rightward in other directions. So this is kind of some of the politics that describe white folks in the wilderness in 1970. But this group, which is kind of, partly voted for Carter in 76, particularly evangelicals in the South, came to Reagan in 1980. Reagan Democrats were union members who, driven by racial resentment, were willing to vote for an anti-union presidential candidate as long as he was seen to protect their racial interests. Reagan Democrats were key to Reagan's election in 1980 and then to his extraordinary re-election in 1984. Reagan, however, begins to split the white populist base by immediately going after unions in an aggressive way, obviously with his attack on air traffic controllers, and beginning a regime of deregulation, which then continues across into what we now call neoliberalism. Next in this is George H.W. Bush runs for president in 88. He wins, and across his first term, he begins pushing, organizing what comes to be called NAFTA. He's also an internationalist. He speaks of a new world order, and he gets the U.S. into the Gulf War. This begins to alienate some white populace who begin to more clearly ideologically articulate what their differences are from this president. Pat Buchanan ran in 92 against George H.W. Bush, pulling together a politics which was anti-immigrant, anti-NAFTA, pro-labor, and isolationist. He self-consciously presented himself as a working class candidate against the preppy elite, George H.W. Bush. He kept calling him King George and calling himself Pitchfork Pat in this campaign. He was unable, of course, to win in 92, but he's able to pull together a certain kind of tight linkage of race and class, of race and populism, and one that's drawing in not just disenchanted Republicans who don't love George Bush, but also a rogues gallery of anti-Semites and Southern Klansmen and neo-Nazis and other people who come out to work on the campaign in places as diverse as Louisiana and in Michigan. He loved populist language and loved the language of insurgency against the Republican regime. When he ran again in 96, throngs of what he called his Buchanan Brigades in many states came out with an even more vociferous anti-immigrant message, also a strong anti-feminist, anti-lesbian gay, anti-pornography message. He told a crowd in New Hampshire after he had just beaten Bob Dole in that early primary, "We shot them in Alaska, stunned them in Louisiana, stunned them in Iowa. They are in a terminal panic. They hear the shouts of the peasants from over the hill. All the knights and barons will be riding into the castle and pulling up the drawbridge in a minute. All the peasants are coming with pitchforks. We're going to take this over the top." And this is kind of the language that he's using, an insurgent language against the Republican Party, that while it is unable to win, it earns him a spot in the 1992 Republican convention where he gives his famous culture war speech. He's beginning to open up a wedge of a certain kind of white populist politics, as I've said, but also he's beginning to pull together a number of people involved in different magazines, political organizations, and intellectuals and writers, and begin to think through what they now comes to be called paleoconservatism. This is the term that invented by a guy named Paul Gottfried, who is had been a member of the Telos editorial collective, the old critical theory left journal. He's also the mentor of America's most punchable Nazi, Richard Spencer. But the most interesting person to come out of this is a guy named Sam Francis. And Francis was a Southern intellectual who had been an editor of the Washington Times, but who was finally removed from that position for saying overtly racist, really white supremacist things. And so finally he's pushed out of that position and moves on to writing for the Council of Conservative Citizens newsletter, editing that, then working for the League of the South, and continually more obscure kind of racist formations on the edges. But at the same time, he's helping to build organizations like the American Renaissance Magazine and others. He's in the news now because he's kind of a patron saint of the alt-right. Alt-righters love him, they talk about him, they quote him extensively these days. Francis, interestingly, was a diehard racist, as I said, but also understood politics as class politics He was deeply influenced by the former Trotskyist turned conservative James Burnham in the 1970s. And he was also deeply influenced by political theory generally. His works continually raise kind of an Althusserian version of Machiavelli, of Nietzsche, of Adorno. And you see these figures coming up for him. He wrote an interesting piece in 1990. I'm going to quote it for you really quickly, called From Household to Nation, The Middle American Populism of Pat Buchanan. He writes, "If the post-bourgeois middle class seriously wishes to avoid its own extinction, it will have to evolve a new group consciousness and a new identity independent of both the moribund bourgeois elite and the techno-bureaucracy of the global managerial order. And it must aspire to form the core of a new political and cultural order in which it can assert its own hegemony." So here is almost a class politics and a class revolt against a managerial class in the U.S. I should have also said he was a close reader of Gramsci and refers to Gramscian notions of hegemony over and over in his writings. But for all the sociological and political acuity that Francis brought to his analyses, he was insistent on framing it all through the lens of race. New class domination for him worked first and foremost against the interests of white people. And it wasn't just that it just happened to work because of a regime of pro-affirmative action, new class elites. For him, it was really a biological question. He began referring to his former Republican allies and comrades as the anti-hereditarian right. Partly what happened from those years forward is that George W. Bush comes along, and although he kind of is using a little bit of populist language, essentially he wants to present himself first what he calls a compassionate conservative, and then builds the most diverse cabinet of any president in history. Puts two African Americans as the chief positions of Secretary of State, and one as National Security Director. Bush himself comes out of a Methodist tradition in his rehab post-cocaine years. He's in Bible groups with blacks and Latinos in Midland, Texas. And of course, he's in foreign policy terms, he surrounds himself with neocons who imagine themselves building new democracies in the Middle East and elsewhere. This all is anathema to these white populists who, after 2008, come back with a rage, inflecting not all the Tea Party, but certain elements of the Tea Party with new kind of nativist, populist language. Some of it's initially aimed at not just Obama's bank bailouts, not just the stimulus package, but the bank bailouts themselves, which they partly blame Bush for, because it was Bush and Obama together who did that. The Tea Party's a mixed phenomenon, but finally coming back, I think, after 8 years of a black president, and remember we talked about white populist notion of a beleaguered white middle puts black folks below and a liberal state above as the two enemies. What you get with Obama for these folks is all of that in the same person, right? A black president. And so, obviously, the reemergence of militia groups and neo-Nazi groups across those years becomes potent. There is a resonance among people around social media, on right-wing radio, and in these far-right groups that help revive these notions of right-wing populism that then become a really robust site for the Trump campaign. If you can remember, when Romney loses in 2012, the RNC gets together and they meet on some island off North Carolina and issue what they call the autopsy. It was the kind of like, oh my God, how did we lose this one? Partly they were concerned because Karl Rove had been saying all the time, as he had with George Bush, you got to get Latino voters, you got to get Latino voters, you got to. And Bush did. Bush was able to get over 30% Latino votes in both 2000 and 2004. Romney is crushed, and so Ryan Priebus, who's now one of the chief racists of the administration, at the time comes out and says, after Romney loses, we have to reach out to Latinos, to blacks, to gays and lesbians, to women. We cannot be the party of angry old white men. He issues the report saying Republican Party has to turn away from all of its racism and nativism if we want to have survived in the future. The one thing that report does not talk about is class. The issue of class is not raised in that report, and this appears to be part of what happens for angry, alienated whites, who it's not that they are doing as badly as working class blacks and Latinos, because they're not. It's not because their mortgages sunk and went underwater to the same degree as blacks and Latinos, because they didn't. It's not because they suffered the same kinds of police abuse in the carceral state as blacks and Latinos, but they experienced some of all these things in a quite a dramatic way, and a loss of privilege, which, as Du Bois pointed out, W. Du Bois pointed out over a century ago, that whiteness is a psychological as well as a public wage, and that if you've got, at least you have your whiteness, then everything else maybe is going to be okay. For people who realize that their whiteness no longer indemnified them, someone like Trump, who would be a racial populist rage machine, could offer a coherent, or Trumpists, let's say, a coherent way of seeing the world, a fairly coherent ideology. That's a short version of how I think we got here. The thing that seemed to be most important to talk about is the danger for the left, because there are elements of left rhetoric in this white populist stuff, and I think that if we don't put the question of white supremacy at the center of our politics, in an anti-Trumpist politics, then we face great dangers. I think that if leftists don't see the way that race is always invoked in class, and that race is always going to be part, particularly in the United States, of how race operates, then it's something that's always going to be our Achilles heel, and it's going to make us unable to confront and defeat Trumpism. Thank you.